Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. For about 3 months, the Oglala and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes have used traffic checkpoints as a way of preventing COVID-19 spread in their land. Governor Kristi Noem demanded that those checkpoints be removed. After the tribes stood their ground, she sent a letter to President Donald Trump, focusing on travel and commerce issues, arguing that the situation is, quote, not a matter of tribal sovereignty, end quote. Though recent issues around the country have taken some of the spotlight away from the story, those checkpoints remain. So we've invited Frank Pommersheim, professor emeritus at the University of South Dakota, to visit with us. Professor Pommersheim's teaching of American Indian law covered federal jurisdiction, rights of indigenous peoples, and tribal court, among other areas. He's written extensively on the topic, including his most recent book, 2015's Tribal Law, 25 Years as a Tribal Appellate Justice. And he joins us now on In the Moment via phone. Professor Pommersheim, thanks for being here. We really appreciate your time.
No, thank you. Good morning, Lori.
Let's start with people who have not really considered why this is an issue in the first place. And the tribes say we have tribal sovereignty. This is something we can do. State government says this is a U.S. or a state highway. And in those cases, no, you can't. Lay the groundwork, because this argument goes back, this dispute goes back centuries.
Yes, I think from the tribal point of view is... they have tribal sovereignty that flows from the Fort Laramie Treaties of 1851 and 1868, meaning they, as any sovereign, have the ability to govern all people found within their borders. But historically, over time, occasionally the federal government acting through Congress and occasionally the Supreme Court have put some limitations on that tribal sovereignty. And there's clearly no federal statute that prohibits the tribe from doing what it's doing, and I don't believe the governor has cited any federal statute that allegedly is being violated. And so it just comes down to the issue whether there are any Supreme Court decisions that indicate that tribes can't do this. And I don't believe there are. There is one important Supreme Court case called Montana versus United States that was decided in 1981 that was dealing with the issues about whether tribes had authority over non-Indians on fee land. And the court in that case said oftentimes they do not. But they do have authority over non-Indians on fee land when there is a consensual agreement between a non-Indian and the tribe or a tribal member, or, and this is the important second part of what is known as the Montana Proviso, is that tribes do have authority over non-Indians on fee land within the reservation when that conduct threatens or has some direct effect on the reservation, threatens or has some direct effect on political integrity, economic security, or health and welfare of the tribe. And to me, the notion of the tribe does have authority when over non-Indians, even on fee land, when the health and welfare of the tribe or its members is involved. This is clear. This case, COVID-19, it's killed 100,000 people in the United States, and I can't imagine something that would be of higher concern in the area of health or welfare. And so,
go ahead.
No. Well, I just don't think there are any federal impediments or limitations to the tribe doing what it's doing and doing with. To me, it's important to keep in mind, why is the tribe doing this? I think they're doing it from the highest sort of a moral and policy point of view. They want to protect people, all people. Not just tribal members, but Indians and non-Indians who live on or travel through the reservation. So I think we need to keep that in mind, Lori, that they're trying to do, I think, a very important thing. And it also marks the convergence of a traditional tribal concern in Lakota culture to protect members of the community, particularly its elders. And secondly, the notion of it's just good public policy to try to limit the potential spread of COVID-19 in Indian country. You just have to look to the problems elsewhere in Indian country. One of the hottest spots in the nation is the Navajo Reservation. So this is not an issue that excludes concerns in Indian country.
If the tribes appear to be acting at with the highest moral concern, from the highest viewpoint for protecting of elders, protecting of their people, in this massive, unprecedented public health crisis, why is what motive does the state have for challenging it?
Well, I think that's a good question. I'm not sure what the state's motivation is. I would locate it in kind of an ongoing historical concern or suspicion that the state oftentimes has in the context that when tribes are seeking to engage in acts of governance, particularly when those acts of governance do have some potential effect in the conduct of non-Indians. I think it's been a very difficult and checkered history in the ability of the state of South Dakota to get along with the tribes right here in the state. I mean, we can go back as recently as the first attempt at the riot boosting bill without any consultation with the tribes. The legislature passed, and Governor Noem was the main supporter of the riot boosting bill, which was initially challenged and challenged successfully. So I think there's a history that we don't want to lose sight of, that it's been difficult for the state of South Dakota to show respect for tribes and try to negotiate and navigate through important issues.
I want to talk about a couple of details when you sort of look at the information that Governor Noem has sent to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and her letter to the president, some of the communications between her and our congressional delegation, who, by the way, Senator Thune and Congressman Johnson and Senator Rounds have all signed on to a letter to the president saying, U.S. Attorney General and the Secretary of the Department of Interior to provide some clarity. As you look through this communication, Frank, there are these things about the effectiveness of the checkpoints and who's manning them. So when we talk about, health and welfare, do you think the state is trying to point out that these checkpoints are ineffective as part of a legal argument? And the other thing I want to ask you about is who's manning the checkpoint, because the governor points out that these checkpoints are not necessarily being staffed by law enforcement officers. Does that matter? Do either of those two things matter for the state in a legal argument?
Well, in terms of saying a checkpoint is effective or ineffective, those are not legal arguments, but you also have to demonstrate, if you're going to challenge it, that it's so ineffective that it ought not to be permitted. And I don't know what the evidence, the sort of the health scientific evidence that the state would have to say that they're ineffective. I mean, I think it's fair to say, I don't know what you, Lori, think and your listeners think, that there's kind of a collision in terms of the way the state is approaching, generally, the COVID-19 issue. It's like they don't have anything in place to sort of regulate what's happening. I mean, the state is kind of wide open in that way, and the tribe is taking a different point of view. Now, each one of those point of views can be legitimate, but I think what the tribe is doing, just to assert it's ineffective without any scientific evidence, is no more than someone's opinion, not based on fact, not based on science.
And the idea of who is at the checkpoints, does that matter legally?
Well, I think in the context of checkpoints, as a general proposition, not simply in this context, is how the checkpoints are actually carried out. If we might switch away from the Indian state, tribal state issue, is just think for a minute when the state has DWI checkpoints. Can the state have a DWI checkpoint? You're not one of my students, Lori, so it's not a quiz, but
I'm sitting here with my hand down, and I'm looking at my desk. I'm just sitting here with my hand down, hoping another student answers that question.
That's why I would call on you. So what the point is on checkpoints, there was a case that didn't involve anything in Indian country, didn't involve tribal-state relations, that went to the United States Supreme Court in 1990. It's a case called Michigan versus Sitz. And the issue in that case was, could a state, the state of Michigan, have a DWI checkpoint without any probable cause to believe that anybody who would have to be stopped at the checkpoint showed any signs of being intoxicated? And the Supreme Court ruled that yes, because it was a legitimate health and safety concern for the state to have DWI checkpoints, even without probable cause. But the key thing was, because it is an intrusion into a person's liberty, is how those checkpoints are actually carried out. And so I think someone could raise a question when the state is having a checkpoint, a DWI checkpoint, and these checkpoints in Indian country, whether they comport with sort of reasonableness in terms of the level of intrusion into the people that are being stopped.
Before I let you go, and if you're just tuning in, my guest is Frank Pommersheim, Professor Emeritus at the University School of Law, University of South Dakota School of Law. We are seeing, Frank, during this time, protests across the nation, peaceful protests, some who have, that have devolved into lawless activity, police action. This is an incredible time to watch the news, and this is something that is close to your heart. You've lived through the 1960s and some of those protests as well, and I'm just wondering, I got to ask you, what you have to say about the time that we're living in now.
Well, I think there's no doubt that the events that we see being played out across the country indicate that we are at a very, very difficult juncture in our history in the area of dealing with race relations, to limit discrimination, to limit police violence and brutality. And this is a time we need leadership. This is the time we need to be able to find common ground. And when I say we, I mean all people, to realize that some of the things that have happened in the last several months in the context of police treatment of African Americans is like totally unacceptable. And we have to find a way to have reconciliation, to find common ground and try to go forward to deal with these issues that are not brand new. They've just come to the surface yet again in our history, and we have to kind of deal with them with good hearts and strong minds. And one last thing in terms of the checkpoints, to me it's important to keep in mind, to me this ought to be a win-win situation, where I think the state should be praising the tribes for taking affirmative action to protect people. That's what the tribe is doing. That's what they're seeking to do. Why should they be on the defensive? Why should they be threatened with being sued when they're trying to protect people? I think that's, you know, that's a value thing, and we ought not to lose sight of it. Yes, I suppose reasonable people can do, you know, can have questions about the means and the execution, but I think in my own experience with people is people understand the tribe's trying to do a good thing here. Why is the state kind of saying, no, you can't? You know, Governor Noem's compromise plan, her phrase, that was sent to the tribes has 3 points. Well, her first point is that there can be no tribal checkpoints. So it seems to me, how can that be a compromise plan when the first part of your 3-part plan is that tribal checkpoints have to disappear? If you're trying to negotiate and have a compromise, I don't see how that's a compromise when the very first point you are making is that the tribes have to do what you say, and what you say is that the checkpoints have to come down. I think we have to find, you know, a middle ground, to concede, to admire the tribes for doing something that's important, both from a cultural point of view and from a public health point of view, to help people. You know, tribes realize they're very rural, they're underfunded, they don't have the health facilities to deal with individuals who might come down with the pandemic. might come down with COVID-19. And so they're being proactive, and I think this is something that we need to recognize and praise.
What happens next? In this, we have the investigation from Attorney General Jason Raunsberg, the South Dakota State Attorney General. We have, the congressional delegation asking for clarity at the federal level. What does happen next? How long could this play
out? Well, it's hard to say. One other thing I would just, because it's part of the public record, put out there is the letter that was sent to Governor Noem by a substantial number of state legislators, particularly legislators who represent parts of Indian country, just saying, you know, we're here to help. We know our history. We want to meet with you and provide some assistance to you. And as far as I can see from the public record, Governor Noem has turned that aside. And I would just wonder why she wouldn't want to meet with state legislators who, if you read her letter, it's very respectful to her and talks about let's try to work this out. And yet it seems to be, at least from the public record, that offer of assistance has been turned aside.
There have been people who have said this is an opportunity for the government to seek clarity and to bring that Supreme Court case or to bring a case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. So let's talk about the path to the Supreme Court. Is there one here?
Well, potentially. I mean, whether a case is going to reach the Supreme Court is always an iffy proposition. And so I would say it would take a long time before it got there, and there's no guarantee as a matter of law that the Supreme Court would take it. I think the law, at least in my opinion, is quite clear that I believe the tribes have the authority to do this. And instead of having, you know, sort of an adversarial, long, drawn-out, expensive lawsuit that seldom brings people together, why would you go down that road before sort of meeting face-to-face with other people in state government, with tribal people themselves, to say, let's talk face-to-face, across the table, around the table. I'm showing respect, and just let's see if we can make this work. It seems to me that is a more human, respectful thing to do before you're off and running in an adversarial kind of situation in court.
Yeah. To your awareness, does the state government reach out to people at the USD School of Law or other tribal attorneys for insight into this? I mean, how much awareness do they have? And that's, you know, speculative,
yeah,
I guess. But
I don't know. The governor hasn't called me. That's tongue-in-cheek. But, yeah. I mean, I would think that you would want to have some meaningful conversation and input from people who have experience in the area, within state government itself, within tribal government, within the federal government, other people who are experts and know the field well, to try to get a sense, because to me, good governance, I mean, let's try to work this out. It's an important thing. You're dealing with a pandemic. You know, it's not a small thing. It's a thing that's killed 100,000 people in our country. So it's a serious issue. And it seems to me that trying to talk and work things out about what's the best way to deal with it and show respect sovereign to sovereign is a better way to go. I think litigation should be the last resort, not the first.
Professor Frank Pommersheim, Professor Emeritus with the USD School of Law. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Lori, for having me on.